The first half is going to be on alternatives to capitalism, and along with Matt Grinder, also from the Vancouver Paracon Collective, he's then going to give a half-hour presentation on participatory economics. So that said, regarding alternatives to capitalism, I'm no expert on this, just somebody who has a general interest, like much of everybody in here. So, and I imagine there's probably many people in here who have experience in understanding of the models that I'll be talking about. So if you do have a point of clarification or some other input, please interject your insights at any point. Same with questions, if you have questions. Ask them at any point. I will, if you ask a question and I feel like I'm going to get to it a little bit later down the road, I'll just ask you to maybe hold on until we get to that point, and then we can discuss it. And then I'll probably pull it back and get the talk back on focus to keep on schedule. So I'll begin just by saying briefly what an economy is. And as an institution, an economy is a conglomeration of interrelated roles and relationships. And in those relationships, there's embodied expectations for certain outcomes and activities. An example would be a factory has roles and relationships of assembly line workers, maintenance workers, janitors, union stewards, shareholders, stockholders, etc. And so an economy on a grand scale has, as an institution, has property relations. It has remuneration and pricing schemes. It has allocation mechanisms, and has divisions of labor. So all the systems that I'll be talking about today have all these characteristics of an institution. And the first system, and I should also say that the models that I'll present, I don't necessarily agree with them all. I'm just proposing them. I'm just getting them out there as models to discuss for, you know, to decide what people want to talk about, what people are interested in. So the first system is central planning. And we think when we think of central planning, the model that comes foremost to mind is the model of the Soviet model of central planning that was prevalent throughout the majority of the 20th century and various other countries that adopted variations of that model, Somalia, Angola, Korea, North Korea, Cuba, China. And they had different variations, but the broad strokes, the broad contours of those economies were centrally planned economies. And today, communist countries that exist, North Korea and Cuba, of course, have implemented little free trade areas for free trade zones. But I'm talking about the classical model, the Soviet model of central planning. So the dominant characteristics of that model would be state or publicly owned property with a central planning authority. And the economic outcome of society was generated by an economic plan. And there's a variety of different plans that were used. There were short-term plans, annual plans, five-year plans, long-term plans, etc. But the key thing is that implementing a plan was mandatory. And so when... So it, that's why it's often referred to as... these kind of economies referred to as directive planning, imperative planning, or command economy. And one of the people who was able to capture the big picture of command planning throughout many of the countries who adopted this form of socialism was a Hungarian economist named Janos Kornai, and he had a description of command economy which he described as a monumental piece of bureaucratic coordination aimed at prior reconciliation of the process of the economy, thousands upon thousands of functionaries in the party apparatus, the state administration, the firm and cooperative managements, and the mass organizations negotiate, calculate, renegotiate, recalculate before the millions of planning commands emerge at all levels. And basically, planners would call in information about the state of the economy and the state of people's desires within society. They would massage that information and come up with a plan to be implemented, and they would decide who is going to do what gets produced, how much is produced, and where it's going to go. And they also made decisions about choosing, hiring, firing, appointing, rewarding, and disciplining managers of each firm. And likewise, each manager also had the same, similar control over each individual enterprise that they operated within. Now, the rationale behind that system was that the planners could, using as much information as they could gather, get the best possible and the most possible accurate picture of an economic plan for society. And many people believed, they honestly believed, that they were in the first stages of socialism. They were they had achieved communism, they were the first stages of socialism, and they had a grand vision for society and for human beings, and therefore had some honorable motivations. However, there were others who were corrupted by power, by filling those roles and relationships within the institution of central planning, who had information, they had power, they were the planners, they were the managers, they were what was called the coordinator class, the managerial class, and they accrued material rewards that were associated with the type of power that they held over the economy. There's many reasons and many explanations about why the Soviet Union model of command planning collapsed. Basically, internal factors and external factors. And internal explanations are described as incentive problems. There's complex theories, the principal agency theories, which is like, who's acting on behalf of who within the Soviet society? Was it the planners acting on behalf of the workers because the planners have this goal of socialism? Or was it the people, the workers, carrying out the plan of the planners because the planners had this great, grand idea of society? It was just like, you know, you couldn't figure out who was the actor here. But there was also things like what's called soft budget constraints, very complicated things. We don't, like, need to get into them here. Other internal factors were war, civil war, famine, so-called backwardness, and trying to develop a largely agricultural rural country into an industrialized society that was going to at some point outdo the Western industrialist capitalist nations. So some of the external problems that existed would be the hostile Western countries forcing a Cold War onto the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union then redirecting much of their economy to military industrialization. But regardless of any of those explanations, even if we were to assume planners did have perfect information and assume that they could possibly achieve the best possible outcome for society, and that, you know, the workers couldn't manage their own activities, even if we were to assume all that to be true, the model of central planning is not a desirable model. Specifically for that reason, that's one very important one, is that it doesn't foster self-management, and therefore doesn't foster solidarity. It doesn't foster equity, and it does, in many cases, it doesn't foster efficiency. Because of these roles of central planners and coordinators, society over long periods of time has developed warped human beings and warped characteristics in a warped society where the planners develop the characteristics of managers and planners, and the vast majority of society develop characteristics of apathy. And this happens over a long period of time. So it's not a desirable model when considering alternatives to capitalism. Other variations of socialism were market socialism. And there's basically two kinds of market socialism. There's state-managed market socialism, and there's labor-managed market socialism. We've got a little thing here. The term market socialism originated with a Polish economist named Oskar Longa. And he got into some debates about, they were called the socialist calculation debates in the 1930s, and there was an Austrian economist named Friedrich von Hayek who he got into this discussion with, among others. And out of that process, he developed the Longa model of market socialism. And it was the very first model of market socialism. And it was a state-managed model. The basic outline was public or state-owned property with markets determining the consumer goods and wages. The State Central Planning Bureau interfered with the markets to influence the overall course of society, the economic course of society. So what that means is, if consumers were just out there buying bread and they were using market supply and demand to buy bread, through the bakeries and the grocery shops and the stores and everything. And there was going to be a shortage of some other raw material over here because people were eating too much bread over here. The Central Planning Bureau would be able to see this, and then they would therefore fix the price over here to influence supply and demand over here. So it was state intervention in the market economy. So that's a very brief outline of the Lange model. It goes into more detail, but the basic point here is that it was a state-managed variation of market socialism. Another more recent model of state-managed market socialism is John Romer's coupon economy. And Romer recommends changing capitalism in two respects. The first recommendation is to abolish all ownership of corporations as we know it, and instead issue everyone identical portfolios of stocks or coupons, giving each person initially an equal share of ownership in every corporation. And people would then be free to trade their shares in one company for shares in another, basically compete. This would be kind of depending on the success of an enterprise on the market, people would then, you know, people wouldn't want to be hold shares in a failing enterprise on the market. So then they would trade stocks and shares over here to try and get them in the successful enterprise. And that's the market competitive nature of that system. His second recommendation is to organize corporations into Japanese style conglomerates, which are also called kuritsus, headed by a major investment bank that would own significant blocks of stock in the corporations and loan its corporate clients funds for investment and monitor the performance of corporate management. And he argues that this system would be somewhat more equitable than capitalism and more efficient. But he does admit that people would have no more control over their work lives and the coupon economy than anybody would in capitalism. Firm managers would be monitored by investment banks, and mutual funds would decide what and how their employees would produce. And there's also, because there's a basic underlying market mechanism, there's no reason to assume that that a coupon economy wouldn't suffer the same market failures as capitalism. And by that, people have certain insider trading information that they will use to their advantage in trading these stocks and bonds inside the corporations and inside the banks. There's no way to really get around that. And also certain people would just have better skill or be, lucky in certain situations for over time generating inequities among the coupon shareholders. So for moving to... this illustrates an interesting point, Romer's model, because he proposes that progressives aim for achieving a coupon economy and overthrowing capitalism, replacing capitalism with that kind of economy. But the interesting point here is that it would take the same amount of effort to replace capitalism for that economy as it would to replace capitalism for any other economy, centrally planning or market socialism or decentralized participatory planned economy, as it would to achieve the coupon economy. And Robin Hennell makes the statement, to put it bluntly, given the strengths and viciousness of the opposition that can reasonably be anticipated from today's capitalists, a coupon economy is hardly worth risking one's life for. So those were two, the Lange model and the Romer model were two models of state-managed market socialism. And if those models were alienating and authoritarian, then there's another model, the employee-managed market socialism of Yugoslavia, that is somewhat more appealing. It's also known as labor-managed market socialism, self-managed market socialism, and employee-managed market socialism. But basically, the model that existed in Yugoslavia existed from the 1950s to the 1980s. Roughly during that period. And in 1948, Stalin expelled Yugoslavia from the Communist Information Bureau. And soon after that, the country engaged in a massive experiment in worker-owned and operated self-managed enterprises operating within markets. And this was through massive reforms. And these reformers sought to free the workers from the dictatorship of the central plan and the dictatorship of managerial managers being appointed by the state, to then self-managing their own enterprises and appointing their own managers. And they embraced markets as the only known way to coordinate the self-managed enterprises throughout the market economy without central direction. Political power. Does anybody have any questions so far? I've been just kind of bulldozing my way through these. Okay. So political power largely devolved into each six independent federal republics within Yugoslavia. And that meant that each of the six republics tried to remain self-sufficient, and they were autonomous in many respects. But there was inefficiencies in this economic system because many of the independent republics would duplicate each other in long-term investment projects. So rather than having one overall goal, you had all these separate, independent, autonomous duplications of effort and wasting resources, etc. I've already mentioned that management was in many cases, it was differed in various points in time throughout the Yugoslav experience, but in the more libertarian socialist points, the managers were appointed by the workers. Another key feature is that managers were unable to fire workers from these enterprises. If an enterprise went under, workers just went to another enterprise. And there was inefficiencies associated with that as well, but that's another technicality for this discussion. Another interesting feature was if firms wanted to start subsidiary companies, it was by law that the firms had to then become an autonomous, self-managed enterprise. There could be no hierarchical relationships between firms. So that was another interesting feature of that model. And that was a very basic and rough outline, and there are some desirable features in that model, specifically worker self-management. Any questions about that? Okay. Another more modern variation of workers' self-managed market socialism is David Schweikert's economic democracy model. And this features common characteristics that were prevalent within the Yugoslavia model, within Japanese capitalism, and within the Mondragon cooperative movement in Spain. Basic three characteristics characterizing this economy were each productive enterprise was managed by the workers. The enterprises were managed by the workers, but they were owned by society as a whole. So the workers didn't own the enterprises, all of society did. And this is just a theoretical model. It hasn't been implemented anywhere. The day-to-day economy is a market economy, and raw materials and consumer goods are bought and sold at prices determined by supply and demand on the market. And new investment is socially controlled. So the investment fund is generated by tax, and then big investment projects are determined according to some forms of democratic planning, and these have to be able to converge with the market. And the democratic processes there is electing various legislative bodies at various levels, and other procedures too, but the various levels would be local, regional, national, etc. And that was the broad contours of the democratic planning, but it was mainly a market system. So also with these models of market socialism, you can also make some assumptions about them, just like you could with central planning. And you can assume perfect market in the theory of markets in capitalism, and it's assumed that there's perfect information and perfect competition. If you were to make all those assumptions for market socialism, you could still say, well, regardless, markets still have the institutional roles of buyer and seller, where there's these interrelated relationships, and the goal is to buy cheap and sell dear. So there's an inherent competitive relationship within markets. And so the goal is to outdo one another. It's also buyers and sellers don't see anything beyond the immediate transaction. So for markets, if I go to buy a car at a car dealership, it's great for me and the car dealer. But as soon as I go out driving my car around and start emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and damaging the ozone, that has a broader impact on society. So that's a public bad that markets, no matter how many taxes or policies you want to put into a place, cannot account for the full amount of social damage. An opposite example of that public good would be if through public spending people got an education and then were hired by a corporation to earn profits. That's also a indicator that markets have an inherent bias towards private consumption rather than public or community consumption. So basically these models assume the markets and market socialism assumes that human nature is inherently competitive, greedy, etc. And I mean, this is true, I would argue, even for cases of market socialism, even where people did have some very strong ideals that were honorable. Unfortunately, the market institution, I would say, has these assumptions about human nature as well. They don't try to imagine more humane and liberating institutions or behavior. And so, again, we have an overall warped development where human and societal development over long periods of time is sent on a trajectory through the roles of buyer and seller and the biases towards public or private consumption rather than public consumption. So those are the basic models of market socialism. Any questions on that? Comments? Okay. I'm just going to touch on democratic planning now. There are surprisingly recently many models of democratic planning have emerged, and no doubt these models will challenge deeply held beliefs that there is no third way. Traditionally, it's been argued that there's either markets or central planning. And one of the main proponents of such a belief was the late British economist Alec Nove. He argued that when allocating goods and services throughout society, that there really was no choice. You either had to choose between markets or central planning. That was it. Nothing else. And Michael Albert challenges Nove's assertion, and I'll just quote Albert here briefly. Nove's only evidence is to pile up indications of no one doubts in the first place that allocation is is complex and important. Nove's presentation argues only from necessity. It must be that there is no third way because it must be that there is no third way. With this mindset, we would have never advanced beyond the institutions of the pharaoh's Egypt. Well, luckily, we can choose between central planning or market socialism or capitalism. I mean, this is something that I personally am advocating for, some variation of democratically planned economy and specifically participatory economics, which Matt will outline shortly. The late 20th century and the early 21st century has seen sprouting forms of models of democratic planning, not models, but forms of democratic planning throughout the world. A wide range of regions and environments spanning from Latin America, Africa, Asia, and Eastern to Western European countries. There's village-level public good planning in Kerala, India. There's the well-known experiment of participatory budgeting in Porto Alegre, Brazil. However, I don't classify these as economic models. They're instances. They're procedures. They're practices. They do not combine broader institutional roles for how goods get allocated, for how workplaces are organized, for how decisions are made, for deciding what you want to consume, how much you want to consume, for deciding what you want to produce, how much you want to produce. So I don't characterize these as models. They're instances in my book. And forerunners. They should be supported because they're forerunners to what could be on a broader scale. So if those are instances, in 2002, a journal, Science and Society, issued a publication that had 9 economists, and they each outlined various models of democratic planning, full models with property relations, allocation mechanisms, pricing schemes, and they were coherent models, and they were debated in this model. The journal was called Science and Society, 2002, Building Socialism Theoretically, Alternatives to Capitalism and the Invisible Hand. And there's a wide variety of models in there, and I would suggest if people are interested to check that out. It's I know it existed at SFU Library. I'm sure maybe out at UBC, perhaps at the public library. But it's really interesting. So I'm not going to really outline any models of democratic planning because I would rather give that space to Matt to outline the model of participatory economics, which does fall in that category. So before I do that, I'll just touch briefly on the tendencies of community-based economics. Many who reject capitalism and authoritarianism, central planning, market socialism, etc., offer other visions of more self-reliant, autonomous, local communities. Specifically, radical environmentalists, radical Democrats, and anarchists argue that only reducing the scale of economic institutions and increasing the self-sufficiency of local communities can we satisfy libertarian goals, reduce alienation, and achieve some form of ecological balance. By arguing that by decentralizing large national economies into small autonomous economic communities, they hope to eliminate the need for coordinating economic activities outside of their communities. And since communities are small, they argue that direct democracy can be adequately solve all internal coordination problems. And just as there is different models of market socialism, central planning, and democratic planning, there's also a wide range of models of community-based economics. Social ecology, libertarian municipalism, Buddhist economics, bioregionalism, ecological economics, eco-socialism, they're all just some of the variations. And they all differ in very unique and interesting and fascinating ways, but they all suffer one major problem, and that they're not coherent models. They're not really proposing anything. Unlike versions of market socialism in democratic planning, there is no model of community-based economics. A real model, in a sense, specifies rules and procedures and institutions for how to make important decisions that must be made in any economy, namely workplace decisions, what you want to consume, how much you want to consume, where it's going to come from. I mean, a key good that might be desired in a community-based economy might be a bicycle or a kite, or maybe gardening, and you have a bunch of rocks and you need a shovel. You rely on other people to get the inputs necessary to produce and make shovels and bicycles and even basic things, much less grander, more complicated human needs that we need to satisfy. So for this reason, all these versions of community-based economics are really visions rather than models. And in these visions, they embody many of the ideals that we probably all share. There are other models. Some community-based models propose keeping private property in markets still. It's more of a libertarian capitalism, which in my mind is very scary. But in the libertarian left spectrum of community-based economics, I see the Vancouver Participatory Economics Collective sees them as allies. Council communists, syndicalists, anarchists, guild socialists, we all share common values, but we would ask you to consider the procedures and institutions of participatory economics. So with that said, I'm going to give the floor to Matt. Thank you very much.
Well, I think we should thank Chris a bit because he put that together over 2 weeks. So a lot of research actually went into that to try to bring together all the major forms of alternative economies that exist out there as basically as visions. If you want to get rid of the system we have today and don't think that the institutions and the system can ever contribute to a good society that we all really want to live in, then the idea is we get rid of that and replace it with something else. And Chris just talked about the various forms of what you could replace it with. But seeing how we're from the Vancouver Participatory Economics Collective, we thought we'd give you our favorite, being participatory economics. So I'd just like to take it back a bit from where Chris was and just go back to basic core values and what do we want to achieve and what do we want to do. So I've got here what are called the four social spheres. There's the polity sphere, which means politics, the economy sphere, which means the economy, community and kinship spheres. And community sphere is basically like race relations, religion, and stuff like that. And kinship sphere is like male-female relations, homosexual, heterosexual relations, child-adult relationships, and stuff like that. So what all these spheres represent are the major forms of how we interact with each other in society. We can interact through each other through power relations. We can interact with each other through the economies, basically buying and selling and working with each other. We can interact with each other through different cultures, different religions, and we can interact with each other through male-female relationships. And usually, if you're going to change the world, you focus on one of these spheres and you say, this is what we have to do to change the world. And somebody a few thousand years ago with Christianity and Islam and stuff, people said, gotta change the community relations, right? And once we do that, everyone's a Christian, everything's gonna be great, right? Everybody's a Muslim, everything's gonna be great. And, you know, it didn't really work. A feminist today might say, well, if we just fix male-female relationships, then that's all we have to do. And a Marxist would come around and say, no, we just fix the economy. That's all we have to do. We get rid of class relationships. We make the workers own everything. That'll be it. And an anarchist might come around and say, no, we got to fix the political relationships, power relationships between people. And I guess the message of Patristic Economics is that you can't just focus on one sphere. You have to focus on all four at the same time. And today we're just talking about the economy, which is one part of the whole vision, right? So if we really want to change the world into a better place, you've got to have not only economy figured out, but you also have to have all these three other spheres figured out as well. But all we think we've really got well figured out is the economy so far, so we're going to talk about that. And just taking it back again, if we're going to build an alternative economic system, what are the core values we want to have in it? Okay, so these are the core values: self-management, equity, solidarity, diversity, and efficiency. And these are basically the five that Parikon, Patristic Economics, thinks are the ones that are the most important. So self-management basically means true democracy. This is where everyone has decision-making power in proportion to how much they're affected by a decision. So if you're going to be really affected by a decision, let's say it's all this group here is going to be really affected by something I do, we better have consensus on it or something, because we're all going to be, say I'm going to, you know, let a poisonous chemical throw out of my pocket here and we all might die. And you better all agree with that before I do it. Otherwise, I shouldn't do it. But basically, otherwise you have a majority vote on something, say it's going to affect all of us, but not that severely, and we can just do it by majority vote to figure it out. But basically, self-management principle goes well beyond electing a leader to make a bunch of decisions or something like that. It's basically where we all get to vote on anything that affects us, and even get consensus on if that's needed as well. So self-management is a very important part of what we think we should get out of an economy. And equity, that just means fairness, basically. You should have fair pay for fair work, and the economy should be fair. If you need an expensive operation and you can't afford it, well, the economy should give it to you anyways, because you know, without it, you'd die. And fairness could also mean that the next generation better have enough resources to live with. We shouldn't take all the trees from them and so on and so forth, so they can have a good life too in the future. And solidarity means that we should basically all be able to live together in a nice way. And the economy should basically promote agreeable societal relationships where we can all basically get along. And we shouldn't promote competition where we all try to step on each other to get ahead. Well, we want the opposite of that, basically. So, and diversity, basically we want the economy to promote a range of lifestyles. So if you want to live in a certain way and it's not harming anyone, well, you should be able to do it. And whereas today capitalism might force us all into a certain mode of living or something like that. And you want a diverse range of goods and services from your economy as well. And last one, efficiency, means that there shouldn't be very little waste in your economy. You shouldn't duplicate efforts. You shouldn't have, you know, 400 big companies all making different brands of toothpaste for some stupid reason, right? You should, you know, if you just need one, you just have one. If you need two, you have two. And you shouldn't ruin the environment by producing a lot of waste and so on and so forth. And speaking of the environment, some people might wonder, well, why isn't, you know, sustainability one of these things? Basically, the idea is that between equity and efficiency and the rest of the values, we think sustainability is covered. Because with equity, you know, you don't want to ruin the environment so that the next generation can't enjoy a good life as well. And efficiency, you don't want waste. So we think it's basically there. Any questions on that? Okay. So there's another thing I just want to talk about too, is none of these other economic systems really address, is how should you reward work, right? Just designing a whole totally new economy here. We're not talking about market socialism, we're talking about a whole new one. And we're like, okay, let's answer the basic questions. What do we want out of our values? Now we're going to answer the basic question, what's the best way to reward someone for work, right? Now, today, how do we reward work? Well, basically, if you have bargaining power, then you can strong arm as much money as you can out of someone who owns something, right? And if you own something, you want to strong arm as much money as you can out of the people working for you. So basically, today we reward people for how much property they owned, if they own productive property. And otherwise, if you're a worker, you get rewarded for how much you can strong arm out of the owners. So you have a union or something, or you have something that's work that's considered rather important or something, and no one can replace you, then you can get more money. And basically, this is very competitive and nasty system, and it leads to pretty disagreeable society relationships. Not very good for solidarity. So, okay, let's get rid of bargaining power. What about output? That's what a lot of people suggest. You know, if you produce something really valuable, well, shouldn't you get rewarded more, right? So, but we reject that as well, basically because if you reward for output, what you end up rewarding for is genetics, right? So I got the genes to be big, tall, strong, and really smart or something, and I'm just going to get more money because I can do the more important things or something. So I'm not actually saying that about myself. I'm just saying that that might happen, right? So basically, if you reward for output, what you create is a society of people getting rewarded just because they're born a certain way. They're very tall. They get a lot of money because they're a basketball player or something like that. So we reject that as being a really fair way to reward work. And it's also very hard to measure, too, because the surgeon, you can say, oh, the surgeon, you know, he or she does a wonderful service to everyone, very valuable and so on. So they should get rewarded a lot because, you know, they're saving people's lives. It's very valuable. It's great output, right? But surgeon couldn't do it without a clean clean floor and clean surgery room. So isn't the janitor just as important, you know? But it's hard to judge it, basically. So reject it as a good way to reward work, a good fair one. So the other way you could do it is effort and sacrifice. So if you work really hard at your job, you put in a lot of hours and stuff, and or your job's really hard on you, like coal mining or roofing or something like that, sweaty hard work, or demeaning work where you're shoveling shit all day or something like that, you should get paid more. So the idea is that if your job involves a lot of effort and sacrifice, you should get paid more. And if you think about this, well, that actually seems kind of fair. You know, if you see some person walking down the street and she's maybe a little bit more well off than you, and we assume our economy isn't going to, you know, have huge disparities in wealth, and somebody's maybe driving a better car than you or something like that, and you say, well, you know, she worked harder. It's kind of fair, right? So basically, that's the par econ way, basically. But the fourth way you could do it is according to need, right? Regardless of how hard you work, regardless of what you did, you're going to get rewarded for how much money you need. Because if you have a disability or something, maybe you need some more. Or basically what you need. Problem with this, though, is it's kind of inarguably right, but there's no real incentive in it. With effort and sacrifice, it seems fair, and you have incentive. So the par econ norm would be payment according to effort and sacrifice, and you temper it by need, because, you know, if there's an expensive operation, you really need it, but you can't possibly put enough effort and sacrifice out to get it, you should still get it, right? And also, if you're a child and you can't actually work yet, well, then you should still have enough money to live, right? Because, you know, you can work later. And also, if you're old, right? So the idea is for Parikon is to take reward people for effort and sacrifice, but temper it by need. Any questions? Okay, so that's how we're going to reward things. So what's work going to be like? So this is, again, it's the difference of Parikon. It's really going from the ground up and really designing a desirable economy, whereas these other ones just took a market or something and slapped on a few changes to it and maybe made it a little more desirable system to work in. So what would work be like? Well, for one thing, it has to be self-managed. We have to be able to vote in the workplace in proportion to how much you're affected by the decision, right? So if you're going to build a bridge and you got to throw in this heavy beam or something, moving this heavy beam, and it's kind of a dangerous job, well, everyone should be able to vote who's going to be affected by that, whether or not we should do this or do it more safely, and maybe we'll save time by moving it in by the beam in really quickly, and we'll get 2 weeks ahead of schedule. But someone might get injured, right, because it's a dangerous operation. So in that instance, something you should have consensus or something, decision on whether or not we move this beam in. But if we're just talking about designing the bridge, we're looking over two alternative blueprints, and people are arguing about which design we should have, and this one's going to last 10 years longer, but it's going to cost twice as much, whereas this one, it's going to last for a good long time, but it's going to be half as much, and people are going to vote about it, which one we should do. Well, it should come down to majority vote, because no one's going to be really, really affected by it, so you end up having a majority vote on it. So this should be uncontroversial. You should have democracy in the workplace, right, in a way that is representative of self-management. But we don't think that's enough. So it's not enough to have a democracy in the workplace, because say you're a roofer, and you roof all day, and you carry the heavy things up to the roof, and you snap them down, whereas the roofing company, the heads of it, the accountants and the managers and all that sort of thing, they don't roof all day. They organize you to roof, right? So if you're roofing all day and you come down to a meeting at the end of the week or something, we're all going to vote about something, you've been roofing all week. You don't know what's going on in the company. You don't know what we should order. You don't know. You don't have your hands in all the facts and figures, right? So the problem is that if you just have self-management, well then, and you still have this division of labor where there's some people with really empowering work and some people with disempowering work, eventually this empowering versus disempowering work thing is going to erode your self-management, because in the end, you know, you're just roofing or collecting garbage all day. You don't know what you should do, right? You got these other people that have their hands in the facts and figures. They'll figure it out for you. So what's the point in having a meeting? So to get away from that, what is suggested is that there's a balanced job complex. So what happens is that everyone shares all the crappy work, you know, toilet cleaning, roofing, garbage collecting, shoveling, septic tank, pumping, all that sort of stuff, sweeping, sorting mail. Everyone shares all that work, and everyone does it. Everyone has some disempowering task that they do. At the same time, everyone has some empowering tasks that they do, some enjoyable tasks that they do, one that enables you to exercise your capacity as a human being and make decisions that affect you and that enable you to, you know, become a, you know, the most fully realized person that you can, right? And also enjoy yourself. So basically, this won't erode self-management, and it's the idea is that people have now an incentive to work, whereas in communism, a lot of people didn't because they had crappy work to do and it wasn't all that great. And everyone's got a good thing to do, an incentive to work, and it's more fair, and it won't erode self-management. So that's the idea for what work would be like in a Parikon, a participatory economy. Any questions, comments about that? Okay. So now we're going to move on to allocation. But first, I just want to talk briefly about money, because this is really different too. Chris talked about market socialism and central planning, and in all of those, you could grab a money, and I don't have any, and well, here's a dime. I can give you money in capitalism, right? I can toss Chris this dime, and he's got it. It's his now. In a party account, you can't do that, right? You'll have credit cards, and I could give Chris my credit card, but he wouldn't be able to use it because he wouldn't have my code or my fingerprint or my iPrint or something like that. So basically, what happens is you can't transfer credits to anyone else. You get credits for working, right? You have this balanced job complex, and you get paid according to effort and sacrifice. But since you're in a balanced job complex, it's more or less going to be hours worked because everyone has more or less the same amount of effort and sacrifice in their job. So you know, plug in your hours, you're going to get money. But your credits working. But when you go to buy your stuff, you can go to the store and you get some credits deducted. So you got 10,000 credits, deduct 10, you got 9,990 credits left, and they're gone. They're out of your credit system. They're just out of the computer, and they're gone. They don't go into the till of the store. They don't go anywhere. They just disappear, right? And you can't give them to anyone else because, you know, you need your own. They need your code or they need your eyes or something like that to do it. So what's happening is that money is really different, and what this means is there's no markets, right? So you can't go buying and selling stuff with Paricon credits because it wouldn't work. You go buy it from the store. So just on allocation, right? So what happens in allocation is this participatory planning process. And what that means is that it's not central planning, it's participatory planning. So you have consumers councils submitting proposals. And as an individual, you also submit a proposal. You're going to say, I want more shoes, more CDs, a new house, whatever. You're going to propose what you want the next year. And also as a neighborhood, you're going to say, we want our streets paved, we want our sewage system upgraded, except the tank sucks right now. We want new light bulbs and lamps, whatever. And you have a proposal. And then as a city, you make proposals. And as a country, you make proposals. Like you could say you need a new space program, that sort of thing. And you vote on these proposals. And these is, as a group, you're going to propose these things. Now, at the same time, workers are going to submit proposals. And they're going to say, this is how much we want to work. This is what we like working at. This is how many hours we propose to work. And this is what we like producing. So then they're going to have these things. So you basically have supply and demand here. And proposes supply and demand, and you have these facilitation boards taking all this information, and they add in social cost and environmental cost to producing all these items, like steel has a big environmental cost, it's going to up it, that sort of thing. And you generate prices from the supply and demand and estimated social cost of producing all these goods. It's like if it's harmful environment, price goes up. If it's hard on people to produce, price goes up. That sort of thing. Supply and demand also are going to come into that. So you mesh that together and you get prices for everything. Everyone looks at these prices and resubmits based on the new prices, saying, oh God, that's too expensive. We don't want that anymore. Or that's really cheap. Maybe we want more of that. So then you have this people resubmit, right? And then people get this new price list, and this process takes like a month. And next time, though, you can't deviate from your last proposal by too much. You've got to start converging it. So now you start making a few more adjustments, and you do like 5 iterations. And at the end of the month, you have prices are set for the year. Basically, you have like a series of different plans that basically reflect the convergence that happened over the planning month. And you vote on one of them, and whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one that's set. And that's it. Prices are set for the year for everything. And all production units know how many things they have to produce, and people are going to more or less buy what they propose. You don't have to, but more or less you will. It's in your interest too. And that's it. Prices are set for the year. And that would be basic. And then the next year you do the same thing. And it would be helped out by what the last plan was. So that's basically how allocation works in a participatory economy. So you don't have markets, you don't have central planning, you have this participatory planning process. And basically the idea is that self-management is reflected in this, because if you're really effective, if you want to to get involved with something that really affects you or you're really interested in, you can't, right? And you can make proposals on what your community should do. And everyone has to listen to you, at least for a little bit, because it's one of the proposals that came in through the facilitation board, and they're required by law to put it up there. And then everyone looks at your proposal to beautify the streets or something, and if everyone agrees, that's what your proposal is as a group, that sort of thing. So you're getting to say in what's going to happen, everyone does, and you get proportional say because you get to vote on it and how much you're affected by it. And the pricing system also works to give you say proportion how much you're affected through this planning process. So that's basically it. That's how it works.